hearing on House Bill 5022. Answer clock, would you like to come on up?
Chair, Minister, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joe Cox with the university system, and I have two tasks tonight. I will be very brief and crisp. I'm mindful of the hour. But the one is to introduce two students who I'm very proud to know, and I think you will be pleased to meet them. And they wanted to offer you a perspective from the leadership side of the student organizations, the student bodies on the campus, in this case, Eastern Oregon University and the University of Oregon, on this new world that we're entering, represented by the model. And then we want to turn to some of the reports that we owe you from the past session, Senate Bill 919, the report on 271. We thought we should also share with you the audits, the most recent audits, and to give you an assurance that Y2K will not slow us down very much at all. So I'd like to have you meet Colby Marshall, who is the president of the student body at Eastern Oregon, and Geneva Workman, who is the president of student body at U of O. What you need to do is be sure to only speak into one mic.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Colby Marshall, student body president, Eastern Oregon University.
And I'm Geneva Woman, and I'm the student body president at the University of Oregon. And we are both executive committee members of the Oregon Student Association. The Oregon Student Association is a coalition of student governments from every Oregon University System institution, as well as Wayne Community College, Oregon Health Sciences University, and as of yesterday, Willamette University. The board of directors consists of the student body president from each member institution, as well as one other student representative.
You could probably each use a mic.
Okay. Technology. Provided by Oregon's higher education graduates. In the 20th century, post-secondary education has grown to become an important part of the lives of many Americans. In college, students experience ideas through academic rigor and cultural encounters. These opportunities shape both the ideology and the civic involvement of students for the rest of their lives. In order for a modern university to provide the extensive training that students need to succeed in all walks of postgraduate life, universities need a stable source of funding. Funding has not been stable for Oregon's universities. 10 years ago, Oregon was spending over 12% of the general fund on public higher education. Today, Oregon is spending only 6.25%, as represented by the graph. Even with the proposed increase of $100 million above current funding, Oregon would only spend 7% of the general fund on public higher education. The shocking thing is that ranks lowest in comparison to our peer states. This equates to a per capita appropriation of $90.75. This is $104 less than the amount paid by our top peer state. As you can see, North Carolina is our top peer state, allocating $194 per capita. As you know, tuition has increased at Oregon State universities. The average tuition increase from 1989 to 1996 was over 90%. This increase was a direct result of a lack of state funding. Local and national studies show that for every $100 increase in tuition, there will be a 1 to 2% decrease in enrollment. The tuition freeze needs to continue to keep college affordable and debt loads down for the students of the state of Oregon.
So I want to briefly talk about debt burden. In 1998, the United States General Accounting Office released a report that proved that there is a direct correlation between tuition and increased debt. The percentage of Oregon University System students that estimate they will graduate with over $20,000 in debt has more than tripled since 1990. And this is only for a bachelor's degree. Debt becomes an issue after graduation. It limits job options, it limits continuing education choices, and it also limits one's ability to accumulate assets. Limiting one's ability to accumulate assets is bad for Oregon's economy. On average, college graduates' total spending is significantly more than those without a college degree. And if the tuition freeze is not funded, tuition will increase and students will graduate with even more debt.
I'd like to touch briefly on what higher education means to Oregon's economy. Due to a lack of state financial support and a skyrocketing increase in tuition, Oregon's university enrollment has been driven to the second lowest level, once again, among our peer states. This number is critical in considering the next generational workforce for the state of Oregon. Higher education is no longer important to the Oregon economy. It is critical to the Oregon economy. Knowledge-centered economies like Oregon depend on higher education for undergraduate and graduate level type research, technology transfer, and continued professional education. Oregon is no exception. We need this type of workforce to stay competitive. As Oregon's knowledge-centered economy continues to evolve and grow, a shortage of college graduates will impede continued growth in Oregon's economy. A reinvestment in Oregon's public higher education institutions will produce a workforce of mathematicians, critical thinkers, problem solvers, team players, technical experts, and teachers. Oregon's workforce will continue to be flexible, self-reliant, and have the confidence to tackle tomorrow's problems. With a reinvestment in higher education, Oregon will enjoy higher than average incomes and produce products and services that will keep us competitive worldwide. Along with so many others, we have stressed the need for legislature to look at higher education as part of a great educational continuum, I believe is the buzzword going around. This continuum starts pre-kindergarten and proceeds to graduate school and also continuing ed. The legislature has an opportunity in this biennium to reinvest in higher education. If reinvestment does not take place soon, the opportunities and training of Oregon's university students will degrade to a point that the state will not be able to recover from. Our best and brightest students will seek out their education in other states, creating a brain drain in the state of Oregon. The graphic that I have up right now shows that the people who are from Oregon and attend Oregon's universities tend to stay in Oregon. And what does that mean? It means an increased tax base. That means those people stay in the state, they produce, they have jobs, they raise families, they become productive members of society for Oregon. We need to keep those students in Oregon. If the brain drain continues, the tax base will shrink, resulting in a lower general fund, and the next generation of legislators will have to make cuts, possibly to higher education. The cycle will continue, and things will go downhill. Now, that isn't a rosy picture. We must choose at this time to reinvest in Oregon's system of higher education. If not for us, if not for these students, if not for us, Geneva and I, sitting at this table, for the next generation.
And so one critical component of reinvestment is also our faculty compensation, because it's the quality of the university's programs that depends on the quality of our faculty that our campuses are able to recruit and retain. Compared to salaries in similar universities, OUS salaries are well below the average of our peer groups. And so in most cases, OUS salaries are only about 85% of the average of their peers. So as the large number of faculty that are hired during the 1960s and the 1970s start to retire, it'll be even more difficult for our OUS universities to compete in the academic marketplace for replacement. It is the state of Oregon's communities and economies that are losing out when our best and brightest faculty cannot afford to teach in the Oregon University system. In our capacities as student body presidents, we're on many hiring committees for teaching faculty. It's extremely difficult, and most students can attest to and have some sort of personal story about losing one of the most incredible faculty that they had ever had because they were offered a better package out of state. It's time to increase our faculty packages, and the OUS system is now in a state where many teaching faculty get paid more or can make more money teaching high school than they can being a professor at our university.
College graduates make citizens.
So participation in higher education impact college graduates in a number of ways, things that we've talked about, learning and cognitive development, attitudes and values, psychosocial development, moral development, socioeconomic status, and overall quality of life.
Now, when I was a freshman, I never would have said the things that I'm about ready to say, so I will currently say them. Compared to freshmen, seniors are not only more effective speakers and writers, they are more intellectually advanced in such dimensions as abstract reasoning, critical thinking, reflective judgment, and intellectual and conceptual complexity. This increased repertoire of intellectual resources permits the individual to adapt more readily, rapidly, and efficiently to changing cognitive and non-cognitive environments, which have important and enduring implications for the student's post-college life.
So just some fun facts about college graduates. College graduates give birth to healthier babies. They have lower death rates. Graduates from college are more knowledgeable about American civic involvement and are significantly more likely to be registered to vote and exercise their register to vote.
College graduates volunteer more. They read more newspapers. They watch and listen to the news regularly. They contribute more money to candidates. They write more letters to elected officials. They attend more public meetings. They participate in more boycotts or protests and are more likely to work for a candidate, a political party, or a political cause. Participating in more community organizations and doing ongoing community service.
Overall, college graduates make better educated citizens. College graduates tend to be more knowledgeable about our government, more invested in our communities, and participate more in our democracy.
At this time, we are going to embellish upon several stories that we feel are very significant and that you should hear about. And these are college experiences. We have the people in the audience today, and as we tell their story, they will stand so that you may put a face on the story. Geneva will now tell the story of Kelly Koski.
So Kelly Koski was born in Hathaway, Oregon, to young parents who separated and then divorced not too soon after she was born. This took Kelly with her mom to Albany to be close to her mom's family and job. Kelly attended at least 12 different schools while she was growing up, and as a result of moving back and forth from her mom and dad. In high school, Kelly became very involved in sports, student government, and the Future Business Leaders of America, and acted as the state policy director and the National Western Regional Vice President. This provided the incentive to not move around, and her high school career was spent at only two schools. The first was Elgin High School, and then she later graduated with honors from Stanfield High School. Kelly is a first-generation college student. Throughout her childhood, she knew she wanted more out of life and always knew that she would go to college. She interviewed at several big universities on the East Coast, including American University and George Washington University. However, an unfortunate car accident her senior year of high school made her want to stay close to home, and so she chose Oregon State University. Kelly is a fifth-year senior and a mother of a beautiful two-year-old girl. Despite having her baby in the middle of her college career, there was never any doubt for Kelly that she would complete her education. She's not missed a term of school, but without the help and support of her family, this would have not been possible. In addition to her parental and academic responsibilities, she's been very involved in student government and has worked two jobs throughout college. Because of Kelly's strong commitment to education and her role as a parent, many of you know her as a strong advocate for the Student Child Parent Block Grant, which helps low-income student parents have access to quality child care. She's also the national president of the YWCA Student Council and advocates for the empowerment of women and girls and works towards the elimination of racism. Kelly will graduate in the fall of 1999 with a degree in human development and family science from the early childhood education program, but her plans don't stop there. She plans to enter graduate school soon after graduation to become a teacher in elementary education, and of course will continue her advocacy for issues that matter to her and the future of her daughter.
I'd like to introduce you to Matt Bell. Like many other students from Oregon's regional universities, Matt Bell is a first-generation college graduate. While stationed in Astoria in the United States Coast Guard, he passed through Ashland on a road trip, and he knew that Southern Oregon University was where he wanted to earn his college degree. While at Southern Oregon, he was part of student government and active in the Oregon Students Association. Matt is also an education programmer for the residence halls and started Southern Oregon University's soccer program. He tutored at Ashland High School, which reinforced his desire to become a high school history teacher. During Matt's last term at Southern Oregon University, while writing his senior thesis, he took advantage of the Oregon University system as a whole, using nearly all of the institution's library for his research. As a veteran of the armed forces, Matt uses his GI Bill to help finance his education. However, the GI Bill just doesn't pay for what it used to. He worked throughout his college career and had to take a year off to work and save money to help finance his last year of education. But in doing so, is managing to graduate debt-free.
I'd like to introduce you to Jessica Pierce. She's from Southeast Portland and attended Marshall High School. Jessica is a constituent of State Representative Randy Leonard and is currently a student at Oregon State University. Jessica is the second person ever in her family to attend college. Although this is her first year at OSU, she's already $6,000 in debt. By the time she graduates in 3 years, she will have accumulated over $20,000 of school-related debt. Although she works full-time during the summer and keeps a job during the school year, it is impossible for her to avoid taking out student loans in order to attend school. She hopes to eventually attend graduate school, but is unsure of the possibility of achieving that goal because she will already be starting out deeply in debt. Jessica is not sure what she will do after receiving her bachelor's degree in political science, but she believes that it is unfortunate that she may have to base her career decisions not on what she would like to do with her life, but on what she can do to make the most money and get her out of the debt she's accumulating getting a solid education. The tuition freeze is very important to Jessica because without the freeze, she will face more debt and further uncertainty about her academic future. She asked the committee to fund the tuition freeze and the OUS budget at the full request from the State Board of Higher Education.
I'd like to introduce you to Tiffany Fine. Tiffany Fine is the oldest daughter of Deputy Danny Fine and Mrs. Diane Fine. Both of her parents are older siblings of large, low-income families. In 1969, both her parents joined the United States Air Force to serve their country and to train for a professional career in law enforcement. After being married in 1971, Danny and Diana were honorably discharged and ready to begin their careers. By 1982, Danny and Diana had four children and a choice to make for the future. They have vowed to give their children all the opportunities they never had. Diana gave up her promising career in law enforcement. She took a position at Clackamas Community College that would eventually provide all four children with 2 years of post-secondary education at minimal cost. Danny worked 60 or more hours a week to compensate for the lost income. Tiffany and her three siblings attended North Clackamas Christian School, where they worked very hard on student council, athletic teams, and choir. Her efforts earned her two top scholarships and an All-Star Team Award for athletic ability and an honor of valedictorian of the class of 1995. Tiffany attended Clackamas Community College using the benefits given full-time employees and their dependents of a tuition waiver. At Clackamas, Tiffany played volleyball, served two terms of student government, aided in fundraising and child care grants, and textbook grants for needy students, represented the college in Washington, D.C. at conferences and lobbying, and trained other student leaders. In the spring of 1998, Tiffany transferred to the University of Oregon. Tiffany considers herself fortunate to have the opportunity to attend college. She continues her work on student government to ensure people less fortunate than her can have the same opportunity she has had. Tiffany currently holds two associate degrees from Clackamas Community College, and in March of next year, she will be the first in her family to graduate from college with a bachelor's degree. Her debt burden will be in excess of $18,000, not including graduate school. Tiffany supports the tuition freeze because she is concerned about her younger sister who is graduating from high school this summer. She believes that without a tuition freeze, her sister will face even larger debts upon graduation from a university. Tiffany believes that compensating our university faculty is important because if we do not, we may lose them. And as a result, we will lose talented students as well.
And now I'd like to introduce to you Melissa Watson, and I hope I can do her story justice. When Melissa was 16 years old, she dropped out of high school after several failed attempts to try for her diploma she just gave up. While living in Spotsylvania, Virginia, Melissa worked as a cocktail waitress in a country bar. In 1994, her grandmother was diagnosed with terminal cancer and was given 6 months. Melissa, being the oldest granddaughter and without dependents, decided to move from Virginia to Oregon to take care of her grandmother. This was a life-changing experience for her, and after her grandmother's passing, Melissa decided to give school another chance. After 4 years out of school, Melissa attended Portland Community College and achieved that elusive diploma. She became extensively involved in student leadership and became student body president at Portland Community College. After 3 years at PCC, Melissa transferred to the University of Oregon. In 2 months, Melissa will graduate with a Bachelor of Science in Political Science from the University of Oregon. She attributes the effort of her professors, her fellow student leaders, understanding employers, financial aid, and academic counselors to her belief that she could continue and succeed in college. However, even with several grants, work study, and working two jobs, Melissa will graduate with over $18,000 in debt. Melissa's graduation is more than just her achievement. It's her family's achievement and its hope to her cousins and siblings that they may have thought that they could not succeed. On her mother's side of the family, every cousin over the age of 14 and her younger brother and Melissa dropped out of high school. They didn't think that they could succeed in life beyond high school, much less afford a college education. On her father's side of the family, she's a first-generation college student. For all of her family, Portland Community College and the Oregon University system has given them hope. On June 12, 5 years ago, Melissa's grandmother passed away and her life changed. On June 12, 1999, she will graduate with a college degree. On June 12, our educational system succeeded in changing an entire family's life, and Melissa will eternally be committed to our system because of it. She plans on dedicating her life to ensuring that others will have the opportunities that she did and almost didn't.
Is Representative Atkins here?
Okay.
It is my pleasure to introduce to you now Geneva Wortman. Geneva Wortman will be graduating this June from the University of Oregon with a degree in Planning, Public Policy, and International Affairs. Geneva's family has a history of education in Oregon. Her great-grandmother, Geneva Mattis, a full-blooded Yurok Indian, was taken from her home on a reservation and sent to a boarding school in Oregon. Neither her grandparents or her great-grandparents or her grandparents graduated from high school, but thanks to low cost of tuition and the availability of financial aid in the 70s, all but one of Geneva's six aunts and uncles graduated from Oregon's university. Geneva's story is one a successful one. Both of Geneva's parents supported themselves through college and graduated from Southern Oregon University. Their college education gave them the capacity to maintain good jobs, buy a home, and contribute to their community. Geneva graduated from Beaverton High School and was awarded the Underrepresented Minority Achievement Scholarship to attend the University of Oregon. At the University of Oregon, Geneva became involved in campus activities because she was passionate about campus, the campus community. Geneva quickly became more invested in the campus and ran for student government and won that election. Geneva will only graduate with $1,000 of debt because of the resources her parents were able to provide and because they benefited from the Oregon University education that they received in the 1970s and due to a substantial scholarship that she was awarded.
So now,
Representative Atkinson.
Is he here? Excellent.
Representative Jason Atkinson is a graduate from Southern Oregon University and would like to tell you his story.
Well, I'm supposed to be there.
They said they'd come get me when they were done with all statistics. Good evening, committee. My name is Jason Atkinson, for the record, and I'm State Representative of South District 51. Thank you for having me here. I'm really excited to testify. Actually, whenever I can get a group of more than two people, this is one of my favorite subjects to talk about. And so I'm very flattered to be here this evening. I guess I should start off by saying that it's true that I've graduated from Oregon's higher ed system, and I have a job. So this is I guess what I'm supposed to be part of the corrugated testimony this evening is I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about myself. I finished high school, and I had great grades. I had no money. And I entered myself into Southern Oregon University. I didn't know really what I was going to study, but I knew I was going to pay for it myself. And so I did, and I started plodding along, and I had a goal of finishing with no debt in 4 years. But along the way, I got interested in politics and couldn't get through being interested in history, so I finished with both. So I finished in 2 years, or excuse me, 4 years, and I finished with no debt. I think part of myself is I worked up to four jobs to do it, but finished my task, which I feel very happy about. Similarly, I married a person who had some significant hardships in her family. And I really was interested in my wife as my then girlfriend. It took almost 8 years for us to get married, so I'm a little bit slow at something. But she put herself through school too, through what amended to three different institutions, but finishing at Oregon Institute of Technology, in which she is now a practicing dental hygienist, a good enough job to support me through graduate school, which I finished few years back, and to support me in politics, so I'm very thankful for that. I think the thing that interests me the most about the higher ed system is that I think that this is one of the places where we have a great opportunity to spend public funds for things that you really can't measure, for good things that you really can't measure in citizens. I've often made the comment about what I believe is Oregon's brain drain. That is, we take students are out of Oregon high schools, and we ship them. We create incentives to ship them out of state. We have tuition that is cheaper in other states to go to. Oftentimes, when they go out of state, they don't come back. In fact, I don't have any statistics with me. I'm sure these people do. But I would probably wager to bet that very few of them return to Oregon. Or, if the other is true, they'll go to an Oregon institution, a university, the university system, and then we'll leave. Whereas that leaving usually is job dependent, and that's really not the focus of this committee. I think that the address of Oregon's brain drain is very, very much an issue that I'm interested in, and certainly you are too here, too, would like to address. So that leads me to what can we do about it. I think there's several things that I talk a lot about. When I talk about Oregon higher ed system, I think that, I know all of us have been inundated over the last few months over the funding equation, which I'm a very huge advocate for. I'm a huge advocate for because going through Southern Oregon University and going through Willamette, I can see the differences in competitive models between schools. Willamette was very competitive in our graduate program of making sure that we were very competitive in the way that we marketed, very competitive in the way that we went after students, and very competitive about the way that those students were presented for jobs. So I'm very excited that now the university system is going to switch to a similar vein. I think that is very positive. It's secondly very positive because it helped out the small regional schools. Southern Oregon, Oregon Institute of Technology, and Eastern Oregon University are all schools that will tremendously benefit from the new funding equation. So I'm very excited about that. As you recall, though, over the last 10 years, our state legislature has disinvested in higher ed. And what we need right now is to increase. We were at 12% at one time. Now we're down to about 6%. And we need to just get up to 7%. And I say we being those three regional schools, Eastern, OIT, and Southern, in order to make the new funding equation work. So I'm very supportive of that, and I need to say that on the record. But I like to use the word world-class when I talk about Oregon's higher ed. I think that that is my long-term goal. Similarly, I was very excited last legislative session when we went to a university system. Of course, there's other states, Colorado, California, et cetera, who have gone to a university model. It has worked very well, and I think that's the first step in the building a world-class higher ed system. And I think we have all the tools. When we get this particular piece of legislation passed, which is our funding piece, we move to the funding model, the new funding model. I think we're on the first step to actually letting our colleges compete. So I'm very excited about that. I'm also very excited about the higher ed system for another reason. And that is simply, and this is something that I like to talk a lot about when I talk to students, and that is the ability to brag. That's one thing that our university system, we have lots of reasons why, but the only thing we don't do very much is brag about how good we are. And that's one thing I like about the new funding model also, because it forces us to brag, which is good. If you recall, 2 years ago, University of Oregon had a world-class TV spot. Did you all see that? Everybody had said world-class at the very end of it, which was a tremendous spot, which has also given me several things to talk about. But I think the thing about bragging that's so good is that we need to brag that Southern Oregon is better than, not as good as, but is better than a Chico, that our colleges are better than a Stanford or a University of Utah or some of the other schools that we can compete with. So I'm very, I think that's something that we should do. Lastly, let me say this. As I came in and started chewing on my degrees, I came in at the very beginning of when we exploded tuition. When we started, it was pretty manageable. By the time we finished, it was more than doubled in just my 4 years. So I know quite a bit about the tuition freeze. But I think there's another element, and I'll leave you with this story. It was about a month ago on an issue. In fact, I don't even recall the issue, but I had three Hispanic people, actually five, but I had three Hispanic kids, high school students, that were in my office lobbying me as hard as they could on some issue. And when the meeting was over, the parents had left, I dragged the three kids back in, shut the door, and sat them down. And I said, you know what? When everything's over, you won't remember at all what you've lobbied me on. In fact, 2 years from now, the only thing you remember is that you did lobby some guy about something, but you probably won't recall what it is. But you will, or you might recall this. And then I went into my standard speech about how important college is and how important access is and how important the fact that investment that you make to go into school, whether you are an 18-year-old or whether you are a 35-year-old professional who's returning back to higher education, what an incredible impact that does and how that incredibly opens up worlds of opportunity that you might not have elsewhere. And so I leave you with that, and I think access is important. Cheap, or not cheapness, but it should be cheap, the tuition freeze, is how important I think world class is, how bad I think the brain drain is, but how important it is for us as legislators and for us to allow our students to brag. I'm very excited, and this is an issue I think that we all as state legislators can invest in with pride and think a lot about. And with that, I'll be more than happy to answer any of your questions. And if you let me talk any longer, I might give you my lecture about why you should go to an organ.
Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
end here.
No, out of the question.
I wanted to reaffirm what you said, that you finished school with no debt at all.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and we have one other student who did that here, but most of our students are ending up with significant debt, and so I think that's one of the reasons to really be aware of the tuition freeze, is because it limits people's choices.
Thank you, Representative Roth. That was the case for undergrad. That's not exactly the case for graduate school.
I see.
And that's not exactly the case with my wife. So I know Sally May better than most. Also, I'd like to add, I was very happy. I have a very large family, and I had the opportunity for my then high school cousin to finish his high school year with me, which I'm, you know, I don't, my wife and I don't have any children, but if they can be as easy as this was, you know. And we have these three little rules about him living with us. The first rule was, very simply, I need to know where you're at night. Pretty simple rule. But my first bout into parenthood, I'd lay that one out there. Second rule was that you had to apply to college and get in. And so for three months, we practiced SATs, we wrote letters of recommendation, we did all this. And then the third rule was that if you're going to leave me without milk in the morning, there's $2 in the top drawer, go out and get us some and keep us stocked. I'm very pleased to announce that this kid with everything against him and no money, is pulling a 3.8 Oregon State University. He's a volunteer firefighter. He'll finish with some debt, but the kid will finish. So I'm very, you know, and that's he'll have some debt, but you know what? He's going to have something that he can do with the rest of his life when he's about 22 years old. I'm real happy.
You're right to be saying.
Thank you very much.
And so just to wrap up, I have one more person to introduce to you this evening, and that is Colby Marshall. Colby Marshall will be a first-generation college graduate. He was born and raised on the high desert area of Burns, Oregon. His family has been in the Lake and Harney County areas for generations. His formal education began at the age of 7 in a small one-room schoolhouse 6 miles from his family's ranch. At times, it was only Colby and his sister that attended the school. After completing grade 6, he attended junior high and high school in Burns. After high school, his parents sent him to a small private college in Texas. It was in Texas that he met his future wife. She was born and raised in Pendleton, Oregon, and graduated from Pendleton High School. Deciding that they both wanted to attend school back in Oregon, they moved back to Pendleton and were married. While living in Pendleton, Colby's wife attended Blue Mountain Community College full-time. She was studying elementary education. Colby also attended BMCC at night after working a full day in the Pendleton grain growers. After a year of this, Colby and his wife decided to continue their education full-time and enrolled at Eastern Oregon University. They chose Eastern because of the excellent teacher education program for his wife and the Oregon State University Agriculture Program for Colby. At Eastern, Colby became involved in several clubs and was elected president of the Eastern Oregon Business Club. He also was selected to be a tutor of college algebra, calculus, and statistics for EOU's Learning Center. At the end of that first year at EOU, he was elected as student senator and served the next year as a member of student government. During this very busy time, he also worked 20 hours a week, tutoring, shoveling grain bins, and driving a mail route. Last spring, Colby was elected as student body president of Eastern Oregon University. Before he took office, he went and worked last summer with Congressman Bob Smith in the House Agriculture Committee in Washington, D.C. In his capacity as president, he's implemented programs on campus that has tied the LeGrand community close to his university and saved his student body over $350,000. At the same time, he's been a team player at the state level in the push to reinvest in higher education. At the Oregon University System Rally, he was the MC for the event that inspired a run on the Capitol. Colby will be graduating from OSU's agriculture program at Eastern Oregon University. His wife will also be graduating from the teaching program at Eastern Oregon. Colby has also been awarded as a finalist for the Capital Press Outstanding Graduating Senior Agricultural Award, and he will also be graduating magna cum laude, the highest honors from his program. He is the result of your investment in higher education in this state. Support higher education.
Wonderful presentation.
Thank you. And we're open to any questions as well.
Madam
Sure. Representative Blair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colby, I want to thank you for remembering that the continuum starts with pre-kindergarten. The students came to see me often, and we talk about that it does start pre-kindergarten as a continuum. And just I want to thank all of you for being here and sharing your stories. I see that Kelly left, but those of you who know me, how passionate I am about your issues, and you didn't bring up my child care issue in the conversation. And tell this panel that we really do need that investment.
I mentioned it.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Good.
Well done. Very good. And as we owe you from the last session, one on Senate Bill 919, which came out of Senate Ed, and then from the previous session, a report on 271, which was the Higher Ed Efficiency Act, which was required to come back. I'd like to briefly touch audits and then YTK. So Bill Anslow will make that presentation.
Chair Minutes, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Anslow, and I'm with the Chancellor's Office. I'd like to invite up George Fernsteiner, Vice President at Portland State University, and Bill Nealon. Our first subjects will be on Senate Bill 271. That was a bill that allowed Oregon's public universities more flexibility in terms of purchasing and personnel matters. And as a part of that process, it was required that both the chancellor of the university and the director of DAS bring forward a report to the legislature in the next session. I believe that the committee has received a copy of the report. These two gentlemen, George was very instrumental in doing some of the initial work to get 271 started. Mr. Nealon was very helpful chairing a committee that allowed for a proper review of this and is here today to report on both.
Thank you, Chair Minutes and members of the committee.
Before I start, I should point out that this is a joint presentation of all four of the legislation, and Mr. Carboni is here representing the Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you, Bill. Again, Chairman and members of the committee, George Fernsteiner from Portland State. On my right is Bill Nealon, who is the chair of the Citizens Panel on Senate Bill 271 Review, and Jim Carboni from the Department of Administrative Services. Very briefly, Senate Bill 271 was passed in the 1995 session as part of an effort to provide greater flexibility and autonomy to the Department of Higher Education with regard to some of the administrative procedures that all state agencies and all other governmental entities enter into, purchasing, contracting, human resources kinds of activities. And it was done as part of a review of the budget for higher education in that session. As part of the legislation, the Director of Administrative Services and the Chancellor were asked to a point.
I guess you just pause for a minute. The information on 271 is a good loophole.
There you go. Okay. That's a look.
Yes. All right.
Okay.
There it is. The legislation in 1995 asked that the Director of Administrative Services and the Chancellor cause an independent assessment of the effects of Senate Bill 271 to be conducted and then presented to this session of the Assembly. So that's why we're here today. I'm going to set a little background as to why we have 271, what we were trying to achieve,
and then turn it over to Mr. Nealon with regard to what the committee found, and finally Mr. Carboni with regard to the effects on the Department of Administrative Services and the actions that they have taken with regard to administrative efficiency. Senate Bill 271 is the Higher Ed Administrative Efficiency Act of 1995. It's one of those long-polluting, high-polluting terms that we like to use on titles. It is probably the most inefficient part of the whole bill is its title because it takes too long to say. The Senate Bill 271 was adopted against a background where higher education had seen about $150 million reduction in state support in the Measure 5 period through the 1995-97 biennium. At the same time, enrollment in the state system schools had fallen. It had fallen from a high of about 63,600 in 1988-89 by about 5,800 students by the time we were in 1994 or 93-94. As we entered 94-95 then, we were taking a look at those numbers and found that they masked an even bigger problem. And that is that we were serving 10,000 fewer Oregon undergraduates than we had been prior to Measure 5 by 1994-95. So what had happened is, as you've heard before, we'd been able to attract Californians to come to the University of Oregon, but we had then lost Oregonians as part of the Measure 5 era. At the same time as that, though, we were faced with a demand from high school graduations that were increasing that said that by the year 2003-2004, we should be expected to have a system not of 57,000 students total, but of 75,000 students total. And yet in 1995 session, there was no additional state money to begin to build back that enrollment. So Senate Bill 271 was part of a discussion that was held in order to provide relief to the Department of Higher Ed from some of the administrative requirements of government in order to provide higher ed with the opportunity then to serve more students without an increase in appropriation. The legislature and the Board of Higher Ed had called for review and reduction of administrative and support costs before that time. There had been about $50 million worth of cuts between 1991 and 1994 in administrative and support arenas. The Oregon State First and then the state system had hired KPMG Pete Marwick, a consulting firm, to take a look at the administrative structures and costs of the state system and its schools, and it came back with something that it called the Oregon problem. The Oregon problem was, in the view of Pete Marwick, a unique one in that we managed to have more approval layers than anybody else they'd ever studied. We had approval layers at the campus level, and then we had more approval layers at the chancellor's level, and finally we had approval layers in Salem, and they all were superimposed on top of one another. And those of you who were here in the 1995 session remember some of the discussions that we had about those issues. Consequently, part of the discussion in Senate Bill 271 dealt with ways of streamlining and making more efficient the work that all agencies, including higher ed, do when they are public entities. In 1995, Senate Bill 2, which was the OHSU Public Corporation Bill, and Senate Bill 271, which was started out life as a public corporation bill for all of higher ed, wended their way through the session. During the session, Senate Bill 271 was changed to exclude OHSU, which then had its own bill, and several of the specific areas, such as investment of cash and others, which the legislature felt more appropriately should continue as they were. So Senate Bill 271 dealt with basically three areas: purchasing, facilities contracting, and human resources administration, personnel administration. The goals of 271 were that higher ed should become more businesslike, reduce its administrative costs, and serve more students than could be served otherwise. And so a lot of the discussion that occurred in 1995 centered around the ability of the department then to translate its newfound flexibility in the administrative arena into serving more students in the classroom. The board adopted its rules and essentially came up with standards for auditing performance and transactions, but the hallmark, the guidance to the various campuses was flexibility, not prescriptive processes. And that was a tremendous change at that time from the way that we had done business. We had followed very thick manuals about how to do things. didn't matter what you were trying to do, you had a rule that would cover it. It didn't matter whether following that rule cost you more than whatever it was you were trying to achieve, you followed that rule. What changed then was that campuses were given greater responsibility and accountability. Decisions would be made close to those who were affected by them, and we reduced the layers of approval. We believe that by 1998, when we came to the Senate Bill 271 review panel, that we had met the goals of being more businesslike, reducing administrative costs, and serving more students. We are serving today about 3,500 more Oregonians than we were prior to the passage of 271. And at the time that we spoke with the panel a year ago, it was in excess of 2,500 more students than we had been serving at prior to 271. We've reduced costs, and we believe we've improved service. It takes us less time to hire employees. We've saved a lot of money on purchasing, and we've been able to contract for repairs less expensively and more quickly. And we've done this while maintaining our commitment to prevailing wages, qualified rehab facilities, affirmative action, and the other social policy goals, which were also part of 271 that we were to maintain. We've done this by changing rules, yes, but mostly what we've done is to change mindsets and expectations. What we ask people to do now is not to follow a prescriptive rule, but to figure out the best way to do something, not just the way that's allowed. We presented this information to the panel, and its chair, Bill Neeland, is here to tell you what they concluded.
Thank you, George. Madam Chair, my name is Bill Neeland. I'm retired from the Oregon University system and got grudged back to chair the review panel, which was created and formed in February of 1998. There were eight persons on the panel with public and private sector experience, four members from the higher education system in one way or another, included George Richardson, a former member of the State Board of Higher Education, and Joan Austin, who has served many institutions on various boards and commissions. Others on the panel had long experience in various state agencies. There, in your notebook, about the fourth page back, including the title page inside, you'll find a list of members. I don't intend to go through many details of the information that is provided in the report. As impressive as we found the data to be, more impressive was the enthusiasm, dedication, and innovation of those staff members appearing before us. These were facilities management representatives, the purchasing clerks, and managers and human resource staff. The biggest problem the panel faced was limiting the presentations to the 3 hours we had set out for each topic. We failed in that two sessions ran toward 4 hours. We found that even in the review of the information in separate sessions, we continued to be impressed with both the speed and thoroughness with which these major changes in process were being accomplished. When we began the review process, just over 30 months had elapsed since the enabling of Senate Bill 271. Two or three examples of innovations might help illustrate the nature of the changes, some of the things George referred to. The first that caught our attention occurred at Southern Oregon University. Under the existing rules, the pre-271 rules, DAS purchasing division contracted for office supplies, paper, and so on from a single purveyor who served the entire state. It was fine and helpful for institutions and agencies closer to the Portland area and down the Willamette Valley. It was less beneficial to those more remotely located. After Senate Bill 271, Southern Oregon University took bids and contracted with the supplier stationed locally. Further, the university delegated to departments within the institution the authority to order off of the original agreement, and the vendor agreed to deliver directly to the ordering offices on the campus. The need for a central warehouse was substantially diminished, and service to the users substantially enhanced. Additionally, ties to the local community and economy were strengthened. This may not have been a direct goal of Senate Bill 271, but it was an acceptable bonus. The panel was also impressed by the improvements made in human resources, particularly in the area of filling vacant positions. Almost uniformly, institutions found that vacant positions could be refilled in 2 weeks instead of 2 or even 4 months earlier before Senate Bill 271. This change reduced and in many cases eliminated the need to use temporary hires to fill critical positions. As a former administrator myself, I had a deep appreciation for that. The third change noted by the review panel did not occur within the Oregon University system, but within the purchasing division of the Department of Administrative Services. This unit, from whose regulations OAUS asked to be freed through Senate Bill 271, has itself undergone a transformation in delegating authority and responsibility to the individual agency. Indeed, EAS reported to the review panel that by mid-1998, the majority of the employees in the purchasing division were engaged in training staff in the several agencies rather than in issuing change orders and patrolling for infractions. It must be noted here that OUS did not invent all these new ways of doing business. They did not invent just-in-time supply and delegation to the lowest appropriate level. Changes came about because of they were suddenly emancipated and able to do the things that they just read about and do them very well and amplify even on those things that we might have expected them to do. The changes adopted by the university system have moved from pre-approval to post-audit. It will be essential that OUS carry out this responsibility actively and thoroughly. These audits, however, need to be qualitative and with an eye toward furthering the good results while improving the questionable ones. The panel spent some time considering additional areas of improvement for OUS and for DAS. Based on discussions with representatives of those units which were giving up control of OUS activities in purchasing, contracting, and human resources. Section 3 and 4 of your report set out some thoughts about areas of further review for both units. The panel felt that most of these could be accomplished through collaboration and cooperation and would not require additional legislative action, although some legislation may be required for some matters. That was not an area into which we intruded, although it was our perception that the momentum of Senate Bill 271 was still very much in place and that further changes may be sought and defended by the manners in which the first challenges were carried out. Thank you.
I noticed that one of the goals is the prevailing wage sort of situation, and I understand that you've met that with regard to new construction and things like that, that you pay the prevailing wage in those contracts. I'm somewhat concerned about what's basically happened with our classified employees in terms of paying the prevailing wage, since it seems as though the contract that you all negotiated with those employees had different terms than the contract the state negotiated with state employees. And I don't believe they got the same sort of deal. They had their raises extended and didn't come about at the same time. And I know that's a product in part of the underfunding of the budget that has occurred, and the legislature has something to do with that, and we did the underfunding. But I am concerned about that because I think a lot of those employees believe that they're not treated the prevailing way. Maybe it's not the prevailing wage, but it's not the prevailing way that other state employees are treated.
Madam Chair, Senator Crowe, this was not within the scope because it was not dealt with in Senate 2-1.
Nobody looked into that.
Yeah. But I'm sure George would.
Okay. Well, George is far away off.
Madam Chair, Senator Crowe, thank you for the comment. In fact, we did bargain independently from DAS in the last go-round.
You're going to do that again.
And we are in the midst of those discussions again right now. We are looking at all of the market-based information as we go into those discussions, and at this point, I do not know how they will come out. Clearly, the support staff for the university system are very, very important to our success and we are very well aware of that and appreciative of everything that they have done to help make the university system successful during the 1990s.
Madam Chair, I appreciate those comments, and I hope we'll all keep that in mind. I think that there clearly is a problem when negotiations take place and we're going to give us some kind of salary and perhaps benefit changes, perhaps improvements, and then there's not the money appropriated to do that. And I know you give agencies instructions about how to handle that, but basically it's a kind of underfunding and they have to take it out of programs or other things. And I think for higher education, that's especially hard.
Madam Chair, Senator Coe, one thing I would offer out of her experience was that the efforts of the classified staff made the implementation of Senate Bill 271 possible. Without their energy, their enthusiasm, and very hard work, we would not be here today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Any other questions? Representative Erickson?
Thank you. I have two questions. One, maybe somebody on the panel can kind of give me a little bit of context behind Senate Bill 271 relative to what we're considering with the model. Would you say this is perhaps the beginning of what is now what we're confronted with running the model? That is the idea that you first give the university system some freedom to be more flexible within itself, and then this is sort of the final step of that, which was concentrated in 1995.
Chairman, Minister, Representative Edwards, I don't know that it's the final step of what was contemplated in 1995, but I do think that it's very consistent. Senate Bill 271 was an attempt to instill flexibility and a new way of thinking with regard to doing administrative business. And I think that the new budget model does the same thing, but in a different context. But again, it's very consistent in its philosophy between the two.
Just one last thing. When I was looking through the report, and this is just really my first take at it, so didn't read the whole thing. You talk about risk management. Can you kind of tell us a little more about what you're talking about here with risk management in the delegation, and ultimately make some statement in here that the board can no longer rely on the checks and balances that have traditionally bound this?
Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, there's a confusion in that risk management has a meeting, and that's how the state runs its insurance program through its risk management unit. What we're talking here is about the risks that a public entity takes when it doesn't have the books and the manuals and the manuals on top of manuals. It doesn't have that codified defense. So people on the firing line take steps. Some of them may be dumb. Some may backfire. And it is up to the agencies or the university system to somehow manage that risk without stifling that enthusiasm. And what we saw as a panel, that the people, because they came out of a heavily codified system, recognized that, saw that risk, and knew when they could freelance and when they could retreat. And we will hope that that sort of balance maintains. But that's the risk we're talking about, is exposing. George may want to think.
Is some of that maybe cultural? I mean, are you really changing something?
Everything is cultural.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Oh. I'm sure I apologize for being out of the room. This morning we heard testimony that the classified workers are falling behind the state agency folks since the Efficiency Act went into effect. And so one of the efficiencies that you're getting is lower salaries for your classified workers. Do you think that with the new model over the next few years there will be an expectation that you would catch up with some of these categories where it's appropriate?
That, again, is beyond the scope of the review panel, but Mr. Bernstein.
Oh, the same method. Okay. Great mind, simple mind.
But I would say we did not realize lower salaries. We just didn't realize higher salaries. Although much of this was done without additional expenditure, and we changed all of this using the existing people and without new resources, and that was a remarkable pickup.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Mr. Senator Gordon.
Thank you, and I apologize for being out of the room for a few minutes as well. But have you covered the information on pages 11 and 12, the Senate Bill 271 anticipated cost savings? And on page 12, I guess, is the actual or the achieved savings. Can you summarize how we did?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, you can see on page, let's go to page 11 of the report so that we're all looking at the same thing. As you can see, the estimated cost savings from Senate Bill 271 were to be phased in over about a three biennium period, with some additional expected higher costs in human resources and then savings mostly in purchasing and contracting and in state assessments. Clearly, the state assessments have been realized, and Mr. Carboni can give the specific numbers that they may be for the upcoming biennium. In looking at the purchasing and contracting ones, the report has concluded that at least that number had been realized at the time of the report. And I would note that I received something again today from the University of Oregon, which compiled the savings from the campuses and showed that there have been some additional savings since that time that will push that number up by another almost $1 million.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name, for the record, is Jim Carboni with the Department of Administrative Services. It's getting very, very late. Many of the points that I was going to cover have already been covered. Just two points I wanted to make. First, about the review panel process. I wanted to express our enthusiasm for that process. It really generated a healthy dialogue between the managers with the Department of Higher Education and the Department of Administrative Services, and that produced a lot of good ideas for improving administration on both sides. So that was a positive outcome, I think, and we were very lucky to be able to assemble such a talented group of leaders for our panel, and they created an environment where the sharing of ideas was useful. Second point is that the panel actually went beyond reviewing the outcomes of the first year of the implementation of Senate Bill 271 for higher education, and they took another step and said, okay, well, we've got an awful lot of information here about administering in a state government setting. Let's see if we can come up with some ideas for possible review and maybe even some recommendations that might be good to look at in the future. And so they made a number of recommendations, and we have been moving on some of those, both administratively and, in fact, during the session, there's a few bills out there that speak to many of the recommendations that are out there. I was going to describe in detail one, but I think given the time, I'll just list some of the bills. You might keep your eyes open. Senate Bill 398 in the current session will correct many contract review issues identified during the panel's review. House Bill 2149 would allow state agencies to consider other factors as well as a bid amount in the amount of award of capital improvement contracts. And this is kind of ironic. The current Senate Bill 271 in the current seventh session and Senate Bill 272 are DAS-sponsored bills, and they would provide a little bit more flexibility in contracting for all state agencies, similar to what higher education now enjoys. And finally, House Bill 2026 would create a public contracting and purchasing advisory committee to study public purchasing and contracting law and hopefully come forward in future legislative sessions with additional suggestions for change around purchasing and contracting in the state government.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the 2 points I really wanted to make.
Representative Winter?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Jim, doing the prescriptive rule changes has opened up a lot of vistas, as I look at this report, not only for what you've done for higher education, but the same process can be used for in other arenas as you look at contracting and some of the things that you have done in order to talk about cost savings. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Witters, I think there are a lot of things that we can do. Certainly, you're talking about risk management, and when you work in state government, there is a lot of the touch risk that was described. But I think slowly we can move towards a little bit more flexibility, a little bit more autonomy, but that takes training, and that takes some amount of oversight and a lot of full-sided review. And those kinds of things take time to develop within the bureaucracy, but we're working toward it.
Jim, are there things that you would do differently now if we could rework this Efficiency Act from the DASA standpoint?
Madam Chair, Senator Trow, I don't believe there are any things that DAS would do any differently. We really, in 1995, we viewed Senate Bill 271 almost as a pilot. This was going to be an opportunity to provide a little more freedom for a very large state agency and hopefully to learn from that. And I think we are and will continue to learn as we get more and more experience under our belt or as higher education does. We'll learn some things. DAS has been changing right along with the Department of Higher Education, and in fact, we've adopted many rules that are consistent with the rules adopted by the Board of Higher Education, sometimes even go beyond that. A lot of that is trading experiences, seeing what one agency does and differently, and seeing if it works, and then adopting those in the other agencies.
Providing by the state system of its of what had been funded by DAS through state assessments. What has that done to that whole process for DAS in terms of state assessments? How have you made up for lost revenue? You obviously don't provide services, so is it kind of a wash? How does it work?
Senator Trow, we have reduced the state assessments to OUS by about $1.5 million, and there was an additional reduction from assessments that OHSU had been paying. I don't recall exactly what that amount was at this time. We have, in fact, scaled down a number of our operations consistent with those reductions in revenues. We don't provide the same services that we did at one time for the Department of Higher Education. A number of positions have been reduced. Fortunately, the legislature had the foresight in 95 to kind of phase that down. So the assessments will phase down over two biennium. This coming biennium will be the first biennium where there will be no assessments for purchasing contracting and personnel coming from higher education. So, yes, we have adjusted.
Senator Hartung?
Thank you. Jim, that was pretty much my question. Senator Trow and I were on the Senate Education Committee in 95, and that was one of the big obstacles. DAS, this was an important source of revenue for them. And so tell me again, has DAS, and how do you measure, you know, DAS's efficiency by the, what is your budget? You do that measure by the number of FTEs you've cut down? Or I still don't understand how DAS can say, you know, we're operating more efficiently.
Well, there's several questions in there.
Yes.
Mr. Hartung. One is, I guess, an understanding of how our assessment process for higher education has been reduced. And, in fact, we knew what the TIFMIS for higher education and the OHSU were precisely in 1995 and use that as a target, start phasing down that amount and collecting that much less or a third less each biennium or half again less each biennium to the current biennium. So, in fact, we are collecting less. Now, you might be asking, did we just raise assessments for other agencies? Assessments have gone up for other reasons, perhaps, but we did not this dollar-for-dollar trade, and as a matter of fact, we can point to positions that we have reduced. I don't know exactly how many positions, but we definitely dropped back, particularly on our personal service, human resource services division has cut positions as a result of this.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Are there other questions? Okay, Steve, do we have public testimony?
No. I'm sure the next item is Senate Bill 919.
Okay. Senate Bill 919.
Thank you very much.
Shirley Clark is going to give us that presentation.
Chair Ross and members of the committee, my name is Shirley Clark. I work in the Chancellor's office, and I'm here to report tonight on Senate Bill 919 that passed the Senate Education Committee 2 years ago and was approved by the 1997 legislature, affirming the critical role that higher education services will play in Oregon's future, the knowledge-based society that our students referred to a little bit earlier this evening. Senate Bill 919 essentially divides expectations into six areas as listed on slide five. The charge, as we understood it, was the following. First, to continue development of performance measures and accountability. Second, to tie performance-based proficiency-based admission standards, we call that PASS for short, tie that to elementary and secondary reform. The next is to expand early college options and create accelerated baccalaureate program opportunities for students, followed by expanding educational opportunity and access by using technology in distance education. And the last two, partnering with business and industry to increase internship opportunities, particularly for students and for faculty, if we could. And finally, to work very closely with community colleges to maximize the transfer of credit. We have a full report that follows under the clip, the 271 report, and it looks like this in the bus color. Titled Implementation of Senate Bill 919. And very quickly, I'd like to review our essential accomplishments in each of the six areas. The first area, again, being develop accountability and performance measures. You did hear about this last Tuesday from Nancy Goldschmidt and Chancellor Cox. You'll recall that our Board of Higher Education set four overarching goals for us in January of 1997. They were to increase access, improve quality, increase cost effectiveness, and assure the employability of our graduates. Related to those four goals of the board were eight performance measures, and they involved such things related to access, for example, new students, increase the proportion of Oregon high school graduates who go on to Oregon University system institutions, and if possible, increase that proportion of high-ability Oregon high school graduates' representation within the system, increase community college transfers, increase lifelong learners, and so forth. For the most part, these recommendations involve improvements enhancements, expansions, increases. And we have been measuring ourselves as we are able to develop information in these areas, and we presented to you a first performance report that sets up some baseline data and trends from which we can examine ourselves annually or biennially as might be appropriate. The new resource allocation model, of course, could be considered overall a performance-based model, encouraging, as it does, the campuses to be assertive and energetic in their recruitment of students, to pursue cost effectiveness because it's a benefit for them to do so, to raise quality because it's the right thing to do and because that also attracts good students and good faculty, and to ensure the employability of our graduates wherever possible to meet needs of the state and to pay attention to high needs areas. The second area, as indicated on slide 7, is to high proficiency-based admissions to K-12 reform. You are very familiar with the reform legislation that the Oregon legislature passed in the 1991 session, and that has affected higher education greatly as well. In 1993, the Joint Boards of Education asked the university system to set proficiency standards for admission because the nature of the reform is oriented toward demonstrating what students know and what they can do rather than some of the more traditional ways of assessing student performance. So we have been very hard at the business of developing the past proficiencies over the past few years and assuring that they are fully aligned with the standards that the Board of Education is setting for the SIM and the CAM. We have agreement on those standards, and this does make Oregon the first state in the nation to agree this close level of coordination between reform strategy in elementary and secondary education and as connected then to public higher education. We have done this very largely on the basis of federal and private grant awards as well as reallocated funds in the Chancellor's office. And the most recent grant received is a second one from the Pew Charitable Trust in Philadelphia, a grant of about $1.45 million this past September. And I think these grants have come to us because we are something of a pioneer in this area, and granting agencies like to provide resources to innovative types of programs. At the very end of the stack of materials under that clip, I think, is a sample newsletter that looked like this, called Path Notes. And I would call your attention to a spout piece in the middle of the newsletter that's a list of high schools that our PATH project is working with. You may find schools in your own district on this list of schools. The grants have enabled us to undertake extensive professional development projects with many teachers in those schools to recreate curriculum, to work with teachers to develop new modes of assessment, demonstrations of students' work, and to develop ways of assessing and verifying the assessments for that work. I think we indicate on our slide 7 we're working with 55 high schools. It has actually increased at this point to more like 60 high schools, and because we have about 200 high schools in the state with another 30-some schools that are mixed middle and senior high schools, this is a very substantial portion of Oregon high schools, and it is a large proportion, practically half of the students in high schools in Oregon. A third area we were asked to work in.
Probably, Shirley, on for the near future, we're going to have students, some of whom will complete the STEM, some will not, some will get a diploma, some without the STEM. The CAM is coming, but it's not here yet in most places. To get into higher ed in this mix of opportunities, are we going to have barriers here? Let's say a student doesn't pass the STEM, but has a diploma. Can that student reasonably expect to get in? Or is there some proficiency testing that will be done before the student gets accepted? How does that work?
Chair Ross and Senator Trow, we have a long-term strategy because it will be a number of years, probably at least through the year 2005-2006, and that's assuming no further slowdowns in the development of the STEM.
So nothing's changed yet, right? You still get in with the diploma?
That is correct. The traditional admission requirements are an established grade point average, 14 Carnegie units in required subject matter, and then secondarily standardized tests. But in our long-term strategy, we will actually be running dual admission systems.
Okay.
There are a number of students who are already demonstrating proficiency in English and in math this year. And so we are beginning the process of passing that information from the high schools into the admissions offices because we want to encourage students to learn how to take responsibility for development of their proficiencies and demonstration of them. And each year we're bringing on another subject matter area. We're bringing on science next. And we have had considerable success in foreign language proficiency. Admittedly, that's probably somewhat easier to assess than subject matters are in some of the other areas. So it's a long and complicated transition, but we have laid it out year by year, and we communicate regularly with the high schools, particularly the counseling staff, about what these opportunities are, because we don't want students to fall through the cracks.
What about students coming from out of state who will not have that kind of system?
We will probably have to have a parallel admission system that would include the subject matter requirements in the GPA, for a long, long time, but at the same time, our past project staff have had annual conferences inviting the admissions offices from essentially all of the either the public university systems in the West Coast state or particular institutions that we know are very attractive to Oregon students, the University of Washington, some of the institutions in California, including Stanford, and we have letters on file of their interest and support because the PASS process offers much more information about students than we typically have with simply the grade point average and the traditional information. And so other systems in other states are eager to learn more about the Oregon students coming to them.
But you're going to have a dual system for in the future.
Yes, we are. We don't see any other alternatives.
Thank you.
Representative Edwards.
Well, I'd like to kind of follow up on that line of questioning because I'm trying to figure out what the future looks like. Obviously, for admissions right now, you rely on SATs, I assume, correct?
Representative Edwards, we do gather SAT or ACT tests information. We do not require that for admission because that's secondary information so that we have some national comparative information on our students. We do use test information like that if there are exceptional qualities, if students are missing some of the subject matter areas, or if there are other aspects of their record that do not enable them to fulfill the GPA requirements and the 14 subject matter requirements. So those tests are secondary, but of interest to us.
And that must be, I didn't understand your admissions process. So you have a GPA requirement, and then you have Yeah. 14 different ones, and you're saying what you're trying to do, I understand this, is trying to combine admissions process at universities with what we're doing with Simon Cam, so that in essence, I was thinking somehow you're actually going to replace, because I always thought ACTs and SATs were sort of the entrance or help screen out what you were looking for. So you're saying you ultimately wouldn't have, if you achieved a SIM, or CAM, I guess ultimately, you get into system at a certain level. Is that what you're saying?
Representative Edwards, that's close. I think we consider the SIM to be a kind of quality check at about the end of the 10th grade. In and of itself, it is not sufficient for entry into higher education, but it is part of that ladder of meeting standards that fits together in a logical and coherent pattern, so that we would definitely encourage students to obtain the SIM as part of the preparation for college, because when they do so, they will know where they are with respect to the proficiencies they've established and those that they still have to demonstrate for college admission. And I think we probably would continue to want to have some national test data on students, so that we would essentially always have an indicator in Oregon of a larger pool of information against which we could compare our students. That's a kind of a risk management in the admissions process, we would say.
Just about one last thing. What GPA do you require to get in now? Ultimately, wouldn't this take away from even a GPA?
Representative Edwards and members of the committee, it could ultimately take us away from the GPA. Our impressions are that parents and schools are going to want to hold on to traditional indicators for the future, perhaps indefinitely, so the GPA may always be available to us, but we'll be paying attention to the proficiency. The GPA is a kind of surrogate for the establishment of proficiencies, I think, and we have always relied on the judgment of teachers in terms of evaluating work, but now we're going to know more than a letter grade for the student. The undergraduate admission requirements vary somewhat from institution to institution. Some are set between approximately a 2.5 on up, a kind of C-plus average. Others are 3 point and above. And those are set in relation to the mission of the institution and with an acknowledgement of the constituent population that the school attracts. So there is some variability. But overall, the students we have been attracting have been quite good students with essentially B-plus averages.
Other questions?
Okay. Thank you. The third, and this is slide 8, third area we were asked to focus on was to implement accelerated baccalaureate programs and expand early college options. We do have a three-year baccalaureate program at Southern Oregon University, a new program, and this program attracted first a small number of students. Now it is attracting more. We expect to have 30 students in a cohort in this program in fall of 99. We think it's going to be an important model for those students who are highly motivated and want to finish college earlier. There are other options, of course. There's a very strong college high program in Oregon, very well represented in Oregon's community colleges and in some of the OUS institutions. And this involves the work with high school teachers who adopt college textbooks and fulfill other requirements, and college credit is then given for passing work in the course. This is quite popular with students in many parts of the state. And as I think you are very well aware, There is a proposal before the legislature that has been heard in the Senate and House Education Committees to create more systematic and widespread early college options modeled after successful programs in several other states, and we have spoken on behalf of that proposal. The fourth area, and slide 9, is to expand access using technology. We have mentioned this in our representations over the last week regarding the number of students we now have in distance education courses. We have something like 320 courses a year. We have about 21 different baccalaureate and master's degree completion programs. You have heard about our university centers in Bend and the newest one in Coos Bay. Much of the education available to students there, but not all, is delivered by use of technology. There are other innovations that we have. Our Oregon Network for Education is a kind of virtual university catalog that is on the web for students, and we are looking for ways to develop that. The fifth area of six and on slide 10 relates to the need to increase internships. I think we would probably say here we're doing a pretty good job of assuring that our undergraduates and our advanced degree recipients have opportunities to complete internships or field work or clinical opportunities. These go by many different names, but essentially they're all alike in that they offer a transition for the student from classroom work into the world of work. And as we all learn, as we make that transition, it's different in the knowing and the applying, particularly when we become part of teams and attempt to apply the knowledge that we obtain in the higher education process. We have done surveys to establish the proportions of our students. We'll be continuing to look at those. We have some unusual internship programs of which we are quite proud. One of them known as the Global Graduate Program. Here we were very fortunate to receive a one-time federal grant of about $4 million that has almost played itself out. We have already awarded 521 internships to students that enable them from travel support money to go to actual jobs overseas in literally all parts of the world. And this is very well subscribed, very popular with students, as you might imagine. You heard about other internship experiences from representatives of our Industry Technology Council last Thursday. The last area we want to touch on, this is slide 11, is the expectation that we maximize academic transfer between community colleges and the university system. I think these days we consider it not simply important, but perhaps a moral imperative to increase the proportion of students who transfer from community colleges to four-year institutions. About 40% of our new transfer students each year are from the community colleges, and that's usually over 3,000 new students. We have, of course, many, many other transfers from four-year institutions around the country, but we have a special obligation to ensure the transfer of students from the community colleges. And there are many strategies for making this possible. Some have to do with the regional partnership. Some have to do with our university centers. Some have to do with providing more and better information from students. And other things are as mundane as simply working to remove the roadblocks in terms of individual courses where there might be some differences between the two-year and the four-year sector. So those are the six areas of Senate Bill 919. And we were finally asked to make a statement, which we'll do here in the most general of terms, regarding the fiscal, physical, and other resources necessary for us to make progress in these areas. And that statement would be that we regard the new budget model as performance-based and responsive to Senate Bill 919, And certainly the intentions of the budget model are very very well coordinated with the intentions of Senate Bill 919, expanding access to quality programs, assuring that new investments go to targeted programs, support for internships as another indicator of quality, and increasing the number of graduates who are ready for employment in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thanks very much.
Madam Chair, again for the record, my name is Phil Anflo, and I'd like to introduce some folks in terms of the audit area. You heard a little bit in SB 271 that there needs to be increased focus on the area of audit as a result of freeing up some of the rural base, and I'm joined by Marv Weigel, who's our OUS Director of Audit. Marv?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marv Weigel. I'm Director of Internal Audit for the Oregon University System, and we're joined this evening by, on my far right, Sharon Walker, who is Deputy Director of Secretary of State Audit Division. Audit Division has statutory responsibility for the University System's external audit. And on my immediate right, by Don Yeggs, who's a partner in Deloitte & Touche. Deloitte has contracted with the Audit Division to conduct our external audit for each of the past 5 years. I believe you've received in your packets copies of audit-related information that's been generated over the past triennium, more, I think, than anybody probably ever wants to read about audits. That's basically what we've done. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this evening, and if I may, before we turn to our guests, I'd like to talk briefly about the role of audit in OUS. I think our function can best be likened in an analogy that I think Chancellor Cox might appreciate to the ballast that exists in the sailboat. Really, it's our role to help ensure that the boat or the university system remains upright and that it steers the proper course. It's for that purpose that that internal audit has been chartered by the State Board of Higher Education and by the Chancellor's Office to provide independent and objective assessments of operations and both at the system at the institutional level. Briefly stated, the major thrust of our work is to help ensure that the system and the institutions operate in a manner that is consistent with prudent management and sound business practices. In performing our work, we concentrate primarily on achieving four objectives. We look to help ensure the reliability of OUS's financial and operating information, the effectiveness and efficiency of system and institutional operations, compliance with applicable laws and regulations, and the accomplishment of established program and operational goals. And in order to achieve these objectives most efficiently, we have developed four principal programs. We have a risk assessment program in which we conduct annual appraisals of the risk associated with specific operations within the system. And based on these appraisals, we schedule audits to evaluate the adequacy and effectiveness of policies and procedures that have been implemented to manage those risks that we've identified as being potentially most significant. We have a consulting program in which we make staff available to each of the institutions and the Chancellor's Office to consult on risk or on policy and procedure issues that have been identified by the institutions as needing special attention. In addition, we're implementing a controlled self-assessment program that provides training to institutional and departmental personnel in developing procedures that will most effectively and efficiently manage their risk. And finally, we're developing the capability to apply computer-assisted audit techniques to OUS's various databases, finance, student information, telecommunications, in order to identify anomalies or trends that may indicate areas of potential concern. To give you two brief examples of our programs, when we conduct our annual audit risk assessment, we take into account a number of factors, including the dollar volume associated with the function and any changes in the policies or procedures that govern its operations. As discussed earlier this evening, these two factors were instrumental in identifying those areas affected by the Higher Education Efficiency Act as being subject to potential risk, and as a consequence, we have conducted or have scheduled a round of audits in each of the areas touched on by SB 271. In addition, given the devolution of functions and responsibilities to the institutions and their departments that has occurred as a result of the distribution of OUS's financial and human resource information systems, our risk assessment also identified the need to audit at the departmental level. As a consequence, we have determined to audit every department at each institution within OUS over a six-year cycle. To date, we performed audits of 140 departments covering all seven OUS institutions in the Chancellor's office. And as an aside, I'd say the results of our work over the past 2 years since we last did this have not disclosed any problems that we as auditors would not normally expect to find in an organization of OUS's size and complexity, whether in the public or in the private sector.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordon, could you elaborate what are those problems that you would normally expect to find, just to put this in context?
As the system has changed, you would normally expect to find that that the procedures are behind operations quite often. It's fairly normal as one implements new systems and new policies that procedures don't catch up, and we expect to find that during the normal course of our work, and generally we do, for example.
Because there's so much here tonight that we're not going to be able to make our way through, are there particular issues, concerns, problems that came to your attention that we should be aware of, or is everything just fine and we can sleep well tonight knowing that all the eyes have been dotted to the T's have been crossed?
I suppose realistically, everything is not ever just fine from an audit perspective. Mm-hmm. I, however, don't think that there really is anything of sufficient materiality that indicates a problem of sufficient depth that should keep anybody awake, frankly.
Okay.
Oh, I don't know about that. I heard a response.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. And I accept that. And that's another thing.
Thank you. I'd like to turn now to Karen Walker briefly about the audit division role in our external audit.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sharon Walker. I'm Deputy Director with the Secretary of State Audit Division. We contracted about 5 years ago with Deloitte and Touche to do the financial and compliance audit of the Oregon University System. We've just renewed our last extension of that five-year contract. So in the coming year, we'll be deciding what we're going to do for the next period, whether we're going to contract or perform that audit. The audit of the Oregon University System that Deloitte and Touche does is a very important component of the audit that we do of the state's financial statements and the federal funds that come into the state. It's a required piece, and contracting it helps us to get that done with our limited staff resources. The other thing that I wanted to just briefly mention, because Mr. Riggs will cover the results of the audit itself, the other thing I wanted to mention is we are currently undertaking some other audits at the Oregon University System, and I'll just touch briefly on what a few of those topics are planned to be. One of the things that we plan to take a look at are university performance indicators, and you've heard a lot of information about that tonight. So being auditors, we want to take a look at that and give some indication of the reliability of that information. We're going to take a look at employee separation processes, management of auxiliary enterprises, institution foundations, and management of off-campus real property. And the last topic is one that we probably will be contracting. We've tentatively assigned staff to all the other topic areas. And so with that, just a brief overview of how the Secretary of State Audits Division audits the Oregon University System, I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
For the record, my name is Don Riggs. I'm an audit partner with Deloitte & Touche up in Portland. And as mentioned, we have audited the Oregon University System for the last 5 years under a just renewed six-year contract. For the record, we'd be happy to keep doing it. As far as the audit, as opposed to what Marv and his group do, which is internal efficiencies and operating effectiveness type of work, our engagement is to render an opinion on the financial statements taken as a whole and whether or not they're presented fairly. And in doing that, we audit the combined financial statements of OUS as a whole and not on each individual school. So while each individual school is represented in the audit report, and we actually go out to each individual school and do audit procedures, our audit opinion is on the Oregon University system as a whole. As far as our reports that are issued, the main one is the opinion on the financial statements, and most recently it was dated November 6th of 98. And that opinion was qualified this last year related to the year 2000 issue, which I'm sure everybody's heard of, and I understand another discussion about that. If it hadn't been for the year 2000 issue and some of the authoritative pronouncements that required certain disclosures, the opinion would have been a clean or unqualified opinion. In addition to our audit of the financial statements, we also issue a management letter in conjunction with the audit. And then we also issue letter reports related to compliance under OMB Circular A133. The Division of Audits identifies the major programs that would be major to the state as a whole and asks us to take a look at those. And we issue reports to the Division of Audits related to federal compliance. In addition, we meet with the Board of Higher Education at the conclusion of the audit and go over the results of all of our findings and are available to answer questions to them. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Representative Winters?
Thank you. I'm looking at the balance sheet and I have a question on it for your category.
Okay.
It's the accounts receivables and notes receivables. Can you tell me and detail what each one of them represents?
Oh, boy. Boy, not in a whole lot of detail.
Well, do one of the receivables, are those loans from student loans? What's the other note receivables?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what the big, one of the big note receivables is from the, I believe from OHSU. When they split off, they had a big chunk of, the way the system works is there's a lot of debt on the system's books. That even though OHSU split off, the debt couldn't legally be transferred to OHSU. So the debt's still on the system's books and the receivables are recorded to recognize that offset because OHSU is responsible for paying down the debt. I think that's the biggest chunk of it. And then our accounts receivables, you have student loans and all sorts of miscellaneous things.
For those debts that aren't collected, where do I find those?
Well, the net of the allowance, that's the estimate as of the balance sheet date of how much ultimately wouldn't be collected. And then as it's not collected, you need to go to the next page, which would be your statement of changes in fund balance. And it would run through as a component of, I'm trying to think where that would be. The numbers aren't huge in any given year. We've got a category notes issued, charged off, and canceled. And the loan funds, it was $361,000 for last year.
$361,000.
Right, so the numbers aren't huge in any given year.
They are if you're looking for money.
Oh, okay.
Representative Ross?
Your management letter is not in here. Is it available to us?
It's available. I didn't bring it to...
I have a copy. Did you provide a copy?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You have Senator Hartman?
Don, on page 26 of the audit, you have item 12, foundations unaudited. And I noticed that number is getting up to $500 million now. And my question is, I know that those foundations are audited, but does your company audit each one of those foundations?
No, they typically are audited by, I think each of the foundations is audited, but they're audited by different firms.
Sure.
And so typically what we do is get a copy of their the audit opinions and the financial statements for the foundations, but our firm doesn't audit them, so they aren't encompassed in our audit. In addition, the numbers aren't reflected in the financial statements of the Oregon University system, so they really aren't subject to the audit. But again, it is meaningful disclosure, so we put it in the footnotes so everybody has an idea of the funds that are going to make their way through the Oregon University system.
Bill, those audits are available to us, are they not, of the whole fund?
Madam Chair, Senator Hartung, they would be available. These are separate entities that have a contractual relationship with the Oregon University system, but there is an arm's length arrangement so that they have separate boards and they have separate activities, and they are audited, and the Chancellor's Office receives a copy of those audits on a periodic basis, usually on an annual basis.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Any closing comments?
I just wanted to make one introduction. I know that we can't do Weiss's case tonight, and I was a little nervous that, given the fact that there was a qualification on the audit, that there might be questions there. And both Marilyn Lanier and Frank Spalda, who have been working on the work of Y2K for the university, are here tonight. I just wanted to take a second to introduce them. I presume we'll pick that up on Wednesday.
On Wednesday. I apologize if we couldn't get to you tonight.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we're done. Thank you. 8:31.
All right.